Welcome to Feels Like Healing, a series of conversations between myself, Al Lewis, and individuals who have turned to creativity as a way of helping them heal. Our need for healing is universal, however, the reasons behind it can be oh so varied. A difficult childhood, a traumatic experience, or perhaps a bereavement and our need to process grief. My search for healing stems from the death of my dad, who died when I was 21 from multiple sclerosis. I believe that hearing other people's stories can help us to process ours, and that the act of being creative can help turn something seemingly hopeless and incomprehensible into something beautiful and hopeful. These conversations are here to provide solace and inspiration, and to show you that healing can happen when we take our deepest pain and turn it into a work of art. This is Feels Like Healing. In this, the final episode of Series 3, you will hear clips from all the guests that I've spoken to, where they discuss the many ways in which creativity has helped them all to heal. We kick things off with the Swedish artist and mental health advocate, Matilda Heindel. In this clip, we are discussing the motivation behind Matilda's decision to write a book about her mental health journey. You mentioned that your hope was that this could be a book that if you could go back in time and hand it to your younger self, that it would be like a self-help guide to that younger you. And that's kind of how I feel like with my album and the music that I'm making, is that I wish if there's someone who's just lost a parent that I could, you know, hand this album to my younger self and help them understand what they're going through. And has that been the driving force behind what you want to do, sort of help people in a way that maybe you didn't have that help when you were that age?
Definitely. And when I wrote that part about like my younger self reading this book, I was like sobbing. I was like, oh my God, like my little baby self, like if she could have seen this now, like it would have given her so much peace. I've been so obsessed with like the inner child healing, because when you grow up and then you start to feel like a broken adult, you're like, oh, why do I feel like I'm a kid still? You know, like I'm supposed to be like 25 soon. Like I'm supposed to be an adult now. Why do I still feel like a little kid? And I think it's because that like inner child is still hurting. And but now I've begun to like switch it from, you know, like I've been on my younger self healing journey for so long that like at this point there are actual young children out there who I could like try to help heal a little bit. And like, so definitely, like I'm really hoping that there's a lot of people, like kids 13, 14, who could read this book and maybe have some answers that I didn't have, that I was desperately looking for, but like didn't know where to turn or where to look.
I mean, the book is called The Art of Feeling Better. Do you think there is an art to it? And if so, do you still think that there is an importance for art and creativity in helping us all with our mental health?
Yes. I think because when you're little, you play, and that is a way for you to relieve stress and to bond with other people and to have fun and feel happy. And I think when you grow up, you kind of lose that. And being creative is just like playing, like we call it like creative play. So I think it's super important that everyone, and I think everyone is a creative, everyone is an artist. So I think we need to make sure that we have enough like free time in our day to put in a little bit of creative play, so that we don't lose our mind in this capitalist world and we can just have a moment to sit down and like check in and do something fun and just, yeah, I think creative play is amazing.
My next guest was the American violinist and composer Curtis Stewart. In this extract, we discuss his latest Grammy-nominated album, Of Love, which Curtis wrote as a requiem of sorts to his late mother, the jazz musician Electra Curtis. Has it been a catharsis for you to put it out there, to perform it, to know that it's out there in the world now?
I think it's both cathartic and it's also like Sisyphusian.
What does that word mean?
Oh, yes, got him. Like Sisyphus, the guy that has to push the boulder up the mountain and then the boulder will also always come back down.
Okay.
The Greek, it's that Greek myth. Sorry, this is my Greek side coming
up. That's cool, man.
Yeah, no, he's like, I think Sisyphus, what was it? Punished for something. He did something bad, and so he's been punished, and he has to push this boulder up the mountain, mm-hmm. just to be doomed to, it rolls back down, and he has to keep pushing it back up. That's kind of how I feel with these concerts. Like, I don't feel doomed. It's more like, I will go through these stages of grief again and again every time I do them. And so including the catharsis afterwards.
Yeah.
And then including the almost like withdrawal after that.
You've created this body of work now that will last, you know, forever, so long as there are humans on this planet listening to music, that piece will exist, and within that piece is your mum. So there's hopefully a feeling inside you that you've laid down a marker there and taken that sadness and created something beautiful out of it.
Yeah, there's definitely, it's there. Man, I thank you for saying that. That helps me to remember that.
I think it's important.
And in fact, somebody at one of the concerts was like, "Oh, it's almost like you brought her back to life," which was crazy for somebody to say. But I mean, because there's a piece where there's video of her writing with her red. She has this red violin case that I now use, and I had the red violin case on the stage. And there's video of her talking. Like the piece Embrace from the album has a whole video element, and you really get a sense for that her spirit is in the room, I guess. That's what people have said.
My next guest was the Welsh journalist and author Jude Rogers. In this clip, we discuss Jude's book, The Sound of Being Human, in which she talks of her grief for her dad, who died when Jude was only 5 years old, and how their bond over pop music was something that would inspire Jude to delve into our human connections with music. What's the feedback been for you? And has it made you feel like you want to do more?
I feel like, you know, I don't know how you feel about this, but kind of making, you know, I've made a book that is, to, as I say in its at the beginning, is to my dad and to little me. It's having that conversation I wanted to have. And there are still maybe more things I'd like to say to my dad, but I don't feel like I need to write another book about it or do anything like that. You know, that is done and I'm proud of it. And I want to do other things now. But I feel like that book was always, I always needed to get that out of me. Once I was writing, I was thinking, God, this, I need to get this out of me. I don't know if you feel the same way about the album, but it's like making something creative out of that, you know, all those years of feelings just was incredibly powerful. Hard, you know, I bet you've had hard times, but, you know, it's kind of, it feels very special, really.
Yeah, I think like you, I for a long, long time stayed silent on it and not wanted to talk about it, never brought it up in interviews. A bit like you say, though, it's scary to do, but hopefully I'm sure you've found in the responses you've had to the book that people can resonate, even if your stories aren't exactly like theirs, that people resonate with the emotions that you've gone through.
Yeah, they've felt similar things, or they've, you know, that kind of disconnection, or, you know, those sudden moments where it all comes rushing back, and times when you feel numb, and, you know, these are the way lots of us feel. And, you know, it's sometimes reading somebody's story that is quite different but shares a sort of emotional connection, but, you know, the facts are different, can be actually quite helpful. But yeah, it's been amazing. You know, I've had, you know, I had a 75-year-old widower who didn't know much of the music in the book emailing me about it, which was amazing. And just like he said, you know, he liked classical music, but he understood what I was talking about. But yeah, it's been a really wide spread of people in terms of music tastes, which has been fantastic. Like people who are really avant-garde and people who are really full-on cheesy pop, you know. I was like, yes, because that's my music taste anyway. It goes like that. But you know, it's music in whatever form touches people in really amazing ways. And it is about emotion. It absolutely is.
My next guest was Marcus Elliott, an American saxophonist and composer, whose latest piece, Fill the Room with Light, was written in memory of his late father. Here we discuss the added weight that gave to the debut performance of the piece in August of 2023. How do you then go to putting that piece into the public realm and performing it with that extra added weight of knowing why you've come to this point with this work and knowing that you're going to have to be in the part of the performance performing this piece? That,
yeah.
How did that feel? It's a big weight.
Those past 5 years had been so hard on myself and my mother and my family. His passing in some ways was a real relief, you know? It was like, it was an exhale. So to be able to kind of celebrate that and to honor him Yeah, I don't know. I was just able to do it. It sound I like saying it now and looking back on it, it's kind of one of those things is like, well, yeah, that is really heavy. I think maybe that just might be a characteristic of me. Maybe just some I do well in the deep end of things, for better or for worse, you know. Yeah, I think that's probably what that is more so of. But, you know, I was just happy to be able to do it, you know. And then also, I mean, there was a lot of things because it was like there was that aspect. But then there was also the aspect of like, I have never written anything this large before and I hope it sounds good. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So rehearsing it and hearing it, I was like, oh, it works. Okay, cool.
Tell us a bit about the name, Fill the Room with Light. Where did that come from?
So I was talking to my brother on the phone and we were talking about our father and he talked about how our father was such a light and would, whenever he came into the room, he would fill it with his light. And I was like, there it is. That's it. That's the title. Fill the Room with Light. That's it. Because it was true, man. You know, before my dad got sick, and like I said, he was sick for a long time, but before all that, man, when my dad walked into a room, it was like, boom, you know, like he had a real presence about him, you know? I feel like that shows up for me in my music. I've gained a new appreciation to grief and I keep it close because, you know, some people think it's something you're supposed to work through. And I don't think that's what it is. I think it's a skill. I think it's a skill set. I think it's something that allows you to love very deeply, to live your life with a broken heart. Just keeps getting broken over and over and over. That's what it's about. Because how else is your heart going to grow if it doesn't break? That's what it is for me.
Next up, we have Susie Fletcher, the resident leather expert on BBC One's hit TV show, The Repair Shop. During our conversation, we discussed why Susie had decided at this point in her life to open up about the difficulties she had faced during her marriage and why putting pen to paper was such a catharsis for her.
So I worked with a ghostwriter because, you know, obviously being dyslexic, that was going to be a challenge to actually try and write it. And on our first recording, because we would have video chat, I just purged. And afterwards, I said to her, I'm ever so sorry. I'm so, so sorry. And she said, you've got it out of your system now, and now we can move on. And it was so liberating. And I just felt all of this tension just leave my body because I had never spoken at this detail to anybody ever. And it was that moment, all right, here we go. If you're going to do it, you're going to do it to absolute maximum. Get it out of your system. And there was so much that was actually good about the relationship. We just had this massive problem that was under the water of the surface that was always present. It was just, when was it going to get a bit stormy?
Perhaps, I suppose, then, therefore, for your family to read it, it's probably been maybe a bit of a revelation for them as well.
I think that's one of the things that sort of still sort of gets me, that my siblings had no idea. I mean, Steve, my brother, who's on the show with me, he knew things were cool and groovy, but he didn't know to the extent. And I chose not to tell them, as I chose not to tell anybody. And this is very, very typical, is you sort of feel that you got yourself in this mess. It's up to you to sort it out. And I certainly couldn't worry my family. They're 4,500 miles away. So that would have been a cruel thing for me to do. So, yes, putting it out in the world has been massively cathartic. And the outpouring from various people, men and women from all over the world now, has been so incredibly touching and supportive. Some people have shared their own experiences. Some people have, men have said, we're not all rotters, you know. And I was like, well, he wasn't a rotter, you know, he wasn't a rotter. So it's good for me to sort of maintain that open-minded understanding of what he went through as much as I try to do with everybody that comes into my life. You know, we're all in this together, we're all doing the best that we can, managing all of the emotions that we all share. And we're only human at the end of the day.
We also held a special live episode during this series at the non-profit organisation Heads Above the Waves. With founder Si Martin, we discussed why preventing young people from turning to self-harm was a cause that was so close to his heart.
And I think deep down, really, I wanted people to notice because I wanted people to actually understand just how hurt I was feeling, mm-hmm. right? But ultimately, yeah, I kept it hidden. I kept it a secret. Now here I am sitting in front of a room full of strangers and recording on a podcast being like, so here is my what was once my deepest, darkest secret, you know? So that's a really strange journey to have gone on. But then also, to fast forward a little bit, when we first set Heads Up, I spoke to my parents and I was like, listen, guys, you know, I'm setting this thing up to support young people who self-harm. So, like, I think it's only fair and in the spirit of that, but I tell you that it's something that I struggled with. And my parents were just like, oh yeah, we know. And I was like, what? And they were like, yeah, we knew, but we didn't know how to help. And that was really profound for me because I realized that basically my why, my purpose, my thing that kind of really drives most decisions that I make is that I don't want anybody to feel as rubbish as I've felt. I want someone else who's sat in 14, 15 year old size position to actually stumble on Heads Above the Waves, be like, oh, here's some quirky guys with tattoos and piercings and some folks who actually have been where I've been and they get it. And they're telling me that it's okay to call the Samaritans. They're telling me that it's okay to speak to Papyrus. They're telling me that actually I should be brave and I should go and talk about what I'm going through and I should try things that might help me cope a little bit better. That's the real kind of purpose is to try and make life better for other people, really.
My next guest was the American academic Dr. Liesl Dawson, an associate professor in the English department at the University of Bristol. Her research explores grief within literature, and in this extract from our conversation, we are discussing the benefits of creative endeavours in the face of grief.
You have encapsulated some of the things I think about a lot in terms of creativity and grief. I love the way your songs allow you to have a kind of conversation with your dad. Mm-hmm. And so many artworks do this. Poetry, where the person who's died kind of speaks back again. Denise Riley has this at the end of one of her poems, which I find really moving. And it's a way of expressing love and kind of carrying on that connection in a new way. I think it gives us that space for that. I also think it allows us to make the person who's died, their presence in our life, more explicit, more obvious. Mm. With Gary Andrews, with his Doodle a Day, his drawings, I love the way that he will draw, you know, his wife Joy, who died, in this different fashion.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, the rest of us can't see Joy's presence in quite the same way, but by drawing her into those illustrations of their life, it's like the rest of us can see the way Joy is still there for him and for his children and still, you know, very much part of the family. And I think it also allows other people into your grief experience. It becomes a sort of touchstone for talking to one another about grief.
And do you think that's important for us to...
Hugely important.
To empathize.
Hugely important.
And,
yeah. And... yeah. I think because we have lost a lot of the cultural and religious rituals for coming together, for expressing grief, and for getting support, we need to find other ways of coming together and sharing what's happened to us and form, you know, different rituals or different ways of being. I don't know if you've come across Jane Harris and Jimmy Edmonds' work. They wrote a book called When Words Are Not Enough. They're both artists. She's also a psychotherapist. Their son, Josh, was killed when he was in Vietnam on a moped accident. And they have these amazing grief weekends where bereaved parents come together, they do art activities, they share their grief, and people are active in their grieving. Mm. And I think, again, I think that's really crucial to grief.
Next up was the American singer-songwriter Stephen Wilson Jr. In this extract, we discuss how the death of Stephen's father caused him to completely reassess his own life and go from being someone who wrote songs for other people to becoming an artist in his own right and releasing his debut album that would be called Son of Dad.
You know, I'd send him a lot of songs, and I remember him saying, like, why don't you sing these songs? Like, these, you sound really good singing them. Like, I know you're like, you're trying to get somebody else to sing them, but maybe you should sing them. And I'd be like, no, Dad, I don't do that. That's not me. I'm the songwriter. Like, that's not what I do. And he'd be like, okay, whatever, you do whatever you want to do, but I'm just telling you. And then one day he died suddenly at a very young age, at a very unfair age, much like your father. And his last words to me were, write a good song for me. And so he knew how important songs were me. Even in his dying breath, he knew what songs could do. And so when he died, like, that person that used to answer that question the way I did, no, I don't sing the songs, someone else does, that person died with him. And suddenly it was like this death and a rebirth at the same time, like, or not a rebirth, a birth, really. Like, it's almost like my brain was rewired instantly. Even, like, I said goodbye to him on an iPhone 8 in the middle of Kentucky, going like 98 miles an hour trying to get to him. And I just knew instantly. It was like, even though I wasn't there to see it, like, my whole brain just instantly changed. Like, my identity changed. Because, you know, I'm a junior, Stephen Wilson Jr. I've lived in his shadow very much my whole life. And so it was like that shadow just literally went away, and the sun was just like just barreling on my face. And it was so bright and so painful. And it's like, now it's all about you, dude. And you don't have that shadow to hide behind anymore, which is a blessing and at the same time, like, very much a painful revelation, and very much an adjustment for my existence. It was, for all intents and purposes, an existential crisis that I was having. And so that's really where the artist stuff began, and everybody goes through this. Like, grief is like the most human thing we got. I didn't know that I was making a record and it was going to be called Son of Dad and I was going to release it 5 years later. I just started just writing everything that I was feeling.
My next guests were Joe Ritchie and Laura McDonough, the team behind Projecting Grief. Projecting Grief tells the stories of people finding comfort, distraction, or hope in a creative pursuit after losing a loved one. Joe Ritchie, a photographer, after losing her brother Jack, became intrigued by those for whom grief had been the catalyst for creation. Fascinated and uplifted, Joe began actively searching for these individuals in order to take their portraits. Laura McDonough is a writer, and after her mum Anne died suddenly, she felt compelled to write about family, identity, and home. Laura was featured on Projecting Grief in 2020, before joining Joe as an interviewer and writer. Here they discuss how their conversations leave them both uplifted and inspired.
Well, I had a day yesterday with photographing two people for the project, and it was just, you come away, and like, it's always me and Laura end up having a phone call, like, one of us driving home, kind of being like, oh my God, this person was amazing. They're going to have such a great interview. Like, they said, we had all these amazing conversations, and you kind of constantly, it's really still really inspiring. And like, just having conversations with people is just so nice when you've got that common connection, which is a horrible common connection, but it's really wonderful kind of that this allows us to have those sorts of, opens those doors for us to have those conversations straight away with people like that.
Yeah. There's no pretense. There's no dancing around it, is there? And I mean, I think if you were to say to somebody, or if you were to, people either get it instantly, or there's a little bit of a, oh, right. Okay. So you talk to people about, you know, probably the most traumatic experience of their life. Like, are those conversations not really hard work? I think there's a bit of an assumption there sometimes that it can be depressing. And I always find it consistently the opposite. I find
like I say, Jews just said, you know, I will ring her afterwards and go, oh God, that conversation with whoever it was just so inspiring. Because, you know, when we have those conversations, yes, we talk about their person, but we set the expectation from the outset, the focus is on them and their creative practice and what they're doing. And to hear about that and what they're doing and to put their focus on that as well is really powerful. I mean, my rationale is my grief is never going to disappear. It's, you know, it's here now. It's never going to go. So why would I try and bury it? You know, it's I find it really healthy and really useful to keep having these conversations. And I can't see that going anywhere, really. I feel like this is, got some serious mileage.
My next guest was Tert Summers, a vocalist, rapper and songwriter from South London, and one half of the jazz rap group Summer Sons. Their 2019 album, The Rain, focused on the grief that Tert felt following the loss of his stepdad, Bill. And in this episode, we discussed the making of the album, The Rain, and the impact that opening up about his grief within his lyric writing had had on Tert.
I'm interested to know what your family think about your ability to articulate yourself in your songwriting. Are they, do you think it helps them with their grief? Have they talked to you more about him?
I think when we all get together, like especially with my stepbrothers and sisters, we're quite good at talking about him and keeping alive. And more than anything, like he just makes us laugh. Like he was hilarious. Like he was the life and soul of the party. And like there's so many stories and things he used to do and little habits that you can just still crack up laughing about now. My own family, like my blood family, we're definitely quite stoic to our detriment. Again, this is why this has been so powerful for me. Because we tend to keep things bottled up and kind of just try and keep it moving. As I've learned, that's not always the best way to deal with things.
Do you think that's also a male thing as well? We find it harder as well to open up about our vulnerabilities.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I think as a young male growing up in London as well, like you have to kind of keep your wits about you and being vulnerable, and it's going to get you into trouble at points. So you kind of learn to wear this armor and put this show on.
And what do you find the response has been from your opening up? Do you get messages from fans who are resonating with the truths that you're sharing?
Yeah, and that's like some of the best parts for me, is like we'll get messages from people that have lost a loved one and they really relate and they really open up. And I think that's the beauty of it, is when you allow yourself to open up on the music and then put that out into the world, people really resonate with that and they'll open up to you. Like I get people coming up to me after shows and saying this album did this for me, and it's amazing. That for me is like the most rewarding part. There's no numbers or nothing that can compare to that.
Yeah, that's the pinnacle, isn't it? That's all you want, is to know that it's that somebody has listened to it and it's helped them, and they've got where you're coming from, isn't it?
Exactly that, yeah. And also, if it's helped them as well, that's just even better.
My next guests were the artist Annie Frost-Nicholson and Carly Attridge, founder of The Lost Project. They have both collaborated on projects which have focused on how we can use creative practices as a catharsis for our grief. We begin with Annie's insight into how creativity has helped her with her grief, followed by Carly discussing how their grief rave offered her the opportunity to remember someone that she had recently lost.
Creativity can really help you to perhaps make your own world up, which can sort of help in a weird way, I think.
I think it helps to, you know, to sort of join some dots. And you're right. I think it's not necessarily, you know, the exact sort of words that they would have said or the stories that they necessarily would have told, but I think it really helps to be able to sort of engage with their sort of, that's the spirit of those people, I think. And when I am making work about them specifically, still now, I feel like the sort of space that I go into really connects to them, you know, so that, and that's really comforting. And it's, you know, really hard to explain to people from the outside, you know, sort of on the outside, or even people who are in my family, because they think that they always get quite worried that I go into these like grief kind of zones, but actually there's a real comfort in it.
Did creating these spaces help you to deal with whatever was going on inside your heads and to heal? Was it a two-way thing?
I think inherently with any creative act, you have an opportunity to be able to either have a mirror held up to you for something that's you've experienced, or that you might have a revelation for, or that, yeah, might bring some sense of healing or peace. And I think that's something, that's an iterative thing that happens all the time. I certainly think with the disco, it reconnected me with Ellie, my friend who'd died. She was an older lady. She was my best friend's aunt, but she was an old school 90s raver. And after she died, every year on Christmas Eve, I danced Born Slippy Underworld, because that was her favourite song, which I did in the disco. And that was a really lovely moment. That was like a kind of a full circle moment, I suppose, in a way. Yeah.
My final guest for this series was Chris Cage, an artist producer from New York. In his mid-20s, Chris was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. But rather than be totally destroyed by this, Chris decided to turn it into a collection of songs, which would become his debut album, Cycles. In addition to inspiring the songs written for Cycles, Chris's experiences with his own mental health also led him to start Sound Mind Live, a non-profit organisation whose mission it is to create a shared space where music and mental health can coexist.
I think at a deeper, almost existential sense, I viewed myself as a creator. And as I was talking about, like, what am I going to find joy in? I realized that just creating things and building things, particularly with other people in collaboration, is where I source a lot of joy. And working in companies, it never felt, you know, or a nonprofit, it never felt quite fully me, that I had this idea of a creative vision and being able to build that with others. In the same way that music is that journey of creating something and seeing how it morphs and molds into the vision it's meant to be, creating an organization was very much that process. So I was kind of looking for something to start and put my heart into. And then music also had become this source of healing at that moment. So I started leading a music support program at the National Alliance on Mental Illness in New York City, which is, they kind of run these free peer support programs. And I, while working at this nonprofit, was leading once a week a weekly support program through music, where we'd come together, play music, write music, share music. And that was kind of the spark of, oh, I can kind of blend these two worlds together, this idea of healing, like you were saying, and, you know, the nonprofit model of giving back what privilege you've been able to get wherever you are, whether that's financial privilege or getting to a certain place with a mental health issue in this case, and giving that back through music. And that was kind of the spark there. And then it was really during the pandemic when I really leaned in both to the nonprofit and using that as a way to support others, and also started writing this album, which at the time I didn't even know it was going to be an album, but it was really, I started really leaning into music production. I started having the time to really focus on lyrics that felt really emotionally vulnerable and meaningful, and just pouring my soul into these two places, really pouring my soul into music as a form of healing.
Please help by rating and subscribing to this podcast, as it will help to spread the word about Feels Like Healing. Thanks for listening.